Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome. We're going to talk about the Public Defender's Office today. As you know, over the last few months, there's been a lot of news around the Public Defender's Office. The public defender herself, Nancy Forster, was fired by a three-person board of trustees that set off a firestorm of controversy in terms of what they wanted her to end. They wanted to end the Capitol Defense Division. They wanted to end the Juvenile Division. They wanted to end the Neighborhood Division, which I visited. We have some folks here from that division on now with us. There is a hearing going to be held in Annapolis tomorrow by Senator Brian Frost, who's our first guest for the evening. We'll also be joined by Nancy Forster after that and by Natalie Finniger and Vicky Pointowski, who work at the Neighborhood Defender's Office, and two of their clients, Muriel Johnson and Andre Webster. But first, I'm going to remind you, I'll tell you all, that we also invited each member of the Board of Trustees of the Office of the Public Defender to join us in this discussion. Margaret Mead and Teresa Moore both declined. The only two who McCurdy did not respond to our request. We also invited Governor Martin O'Malley and his office to comment. His office did not respond to our request for a comment either. But it will be an issue that will be controversial during the legislative session, and the hearing is tomorrow. And I'm here with my Monday co-host, Anthony McCarthy.
Great to be with you, Mark.
Always.
Very important topic. A lot of people, as we posted this information online, very interested in this discussion today.
And Anthony, of course, you can hear solo on his own every Friday, 5 to 7 p.m. And you can join us now at 410-889-889. What's number?
319-8888. 410-319-8888.
I needed that today. Thank you. 410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. Senator Brian Frosch, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thanks for having me with you.
Hi, Senator Frosch.
Hi.
We may call you tomorrow later in the day just to see what happened. But,
okay.
Because I know you. This is all before the fact. But
right.
Tell us about the hearing you're having tomorrow.
Well, we obviously the disagreements between Nancy Forster and the board resulted in her termination. I don't view it as our purview to figure out who's right and who's wrong in terms of that specific personnel issue, but it highlighted for us a number of policy issues, a couple of which you mentioned, and I think our committee wants to get a sense of those issues, what the merits are on those issues, and one other, which was, as I understand it, a subject of disagreement between Ms. Forster and the board, was whether or not the Public Defender's Office ought to hire and keep social workers.
Right.
And those are the things we're going to be looking at tomorrow.
Well, let's talk about that for a moment. I mean, these are some of the key issues that were the board and Nancy Forster disagreed on, and she refused to carry out their wishes because she said they were either counterproductive to the work they do or illegal, because there's a statute that governs this and she would be going against the statute itself. They wanted her to disband the Capitol Defense Division.
Right.
Disperse their staff into the District Public Defender's Office, disband the Juvenile Defender Division, close the Northwest Community Defenders Operations, which we'll talk more about during the course of the hour, which is modeled on very successful operations in the Bronx and in Harlem, which they went to visit, and to take the children in need of supervision. Is that right? Children in need
right.
of
yes.
assistance, excuse
assistance.
Me. The Cine cases, and give them out to private attorneys. So this kind of really does beg the question of what is a public defender supposed to do? Build wraparound services or not?
Right. Well, I think, and I have to say, I'm not an expert on this stuff by any stretch of the imagination, and one of the things, I hope to gain some knowledge tomorrow, but I think there is an argument to be made, and I'm sure Ms. Forster will make it eloquently, that it's pointless to have the public defender merely stand up in court and try to get the lowest possible sentence for its clients, that if it can assist its clients in getting off drugs or to solve the familial or social problems that individuals might have, that it can actually keep the folks out of court, keep them out of trouble, and that that's better for the public defender's office, better for society, better for the state, less expensive than if it merely shows up in court every time somebody's charged with a crime.
Now, one of the things that was said to me by Natalie Finniger, who's one of our guests today, who's sort of the Neighborhood Defenders Northwest program. That's part of the one of the two programs we're talking about. One is in Montgomery County. I don't know if it's in your district or not, but it's in Montgomery County, and one is in Baltimore City. That all these officers expect cuts.
Yep.
But they don't expect wholesale slaughter. And kind of undercutting that. That wasn't our exact words. I paraphrased that. But to kind of cut out the heart of what's been going on. And sometimes I think when we hit these budget cuts and look at the tight times we're facing in the terms of the budget, that we don't begin to think creatively. All we kind of figure out in politics is how to slash and burn and how to think creatively, how to work our way out of these issues.
Right. Well, I mean, the bad news is that we've been thinking creatively for the past really 6 or 7 years. We've faced deficits or revenue shortfalls in each of the past number of cycles, and we've basically cut to the bone. Now we're starting to cut bone, and yes, we can think creatively, but we've patched things together for so long. It's hard to know how we're going to keep things together in the face of the shortfalls that we have this year and that are projected for the next couple of years.
Go ahead.
Senator Frosch, this is Anthony McCarthy. I'm looking forward to the hearing tomorrow, but one of the basic questions, as I read through some of the correspondence that was taking place between Mr. McCurdy and Ms. Forrester, is this idea of the actual authority of the board. I mean, the statute's very clear that they operate to advise the public defender and advise the office. And I know that your hearing is not about who's right or wrong, but will that question be explored at all? What was the authority of this board to actually terminate the public defender?
Anthony, it's been a while since I looked at the statute, but I think you're right. It's specifically given an advisory role, but it also has the authority to hire and fire the public defender. So, you know, it has the ability, as this board did, to say, look, we advise you to do X. If you don't do X, we're going to fire you. So, I mean, I think that I know our committee will look at the role of the board and the makeup of the board. One of the most obvious issues that we'll face, I think, going forward is what ought to be the authority of the board and who should be on the board. Three people, I think, is too small a cohort for responsibility of this magnitude.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think we're going to be looking at whether the board ought to be expanded, whether its role ought to be redefined in some way. I think it's appropriate that somebody other than the chief executive hire and fire the public defender, although that's a fair question too. At any rate, if the board continues to have the authority to hire and fire, then perhaps the membership ought to be expanded.
Another issue that was raised, I guess you've been privy to all these letters that were filed in the 90s by board member Mr. McCready, and it just seems like there's a lot of conflict of interest here. At least my kind of journalistic, simple-minded reasoning looking at it is that it just seems that
there's nothing simple-minded about you, Mark Stein.
is that you look at these and you know that a lot of lawyers would love to see things like the public defender's office, others kind of more dismantled. The more dismantled they become, the more business goes to private attorneys, and it just does seem like those questions could be raised. I don't know if it's real or not. Do you plan to raise those questions?
I'm sure somebody will raise those questions, even if it's only the pesky journalists.
But you have some pesky members of your committee. I know who's on the committee.
We do. I think if Mr. McCurdy had written those letters last week or last year, people would be very concerned about his role. I'm sure somebody will ask him what he now thinks about the positions that he took. I don't know, was it 15 or so years ago?
Yeah, about 15 years ago.
It'll be interesting to see what his perspective is now. It's certainly awkward for him, at least, that those letters are out there in the public domain. But I don't think that somebody who holds those views today is somebody who ought to be one of a 3-member board for the public defender. But I would suppose that Mr. McCurdy has matured in his outlook and his experience and doesn't hold the view that the public defender is taking away business from private attorneys. If the public defender were reaching out and defending folks who had the means to defend themselves, that would be a concern. But I've never heard those views expressed other than in those old letters from Mr. McCurdy.
Well, we will look forward to what time is the hearing tomorrow? The hearing takes place
at 1:00.
At 1:00, and you plan it to go how long?
Oh, until it's over.
All right.
I don't know. I mean, I'm hoping it won't be that long, but it could go several hours.
Well, we'll follow it. And hopefully give you a call and maybe some of the members of the committee. I know that you have Senator Brochins on the committee, Senator Foran's on the committee,
yep.
Senator Haynes and the Republican Senator Mooney's on that committee as well as Senator Raskin and a number of others, Norman Stone. So interesting committee, and we'll look forward to talking to you and some of the members when this is done.
Thanks. It was good to be with you.
One last question before I forget, Brian.
Sure.
Will this lead to some legislative discussions inside the Assembly in January?
Yeah, I'm certain it will. I mean, if in no other respect with respect to the makeup of the board, but the policies, you know, that you identified, the Capital Crimes Unit, social workers, et cetera, don't lend themselves as easily to legislation, but certainly due to the budget process. And so they'll all be topics of conversation, I think, in January.
Senator Frosch, thank you so much.
Good to be with you.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Senator Brian Frosch was with us just now, who is the senator who heads the Judicial Proceedings Committee that will hear this hearing tomorrow. We are joined now on the phone by Nancy Forrester, former Maryland public defender who was fired on August 21st. And was that week we had a program about that with Doug Colbert and others on the air. You were on that show, too.
I was here.
You were here that day, Anthony McCarthy. Mm-hmm. Nancy, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Hi. Thank you, Mark. Good to be here.
It's great to have you with us. And Natalie Finniger is in the studio, who started the Neighborhood Defenders Northwest Program, part of the Maryland Office of the Public Defender. She started this in 2007. Nancy,
hello.
Welcome. Natalie, welcome. Sorry. And we're also joined by Muriel Johnson, Vietnam veteran, currently studying addiction counseling, who is one of the clients in that office.
Yes. Hello.
Good to have you here with us as well. And Vicki Pontowski is with us, who's a social worker with the Neighborhood Defenders Office.
She's also
a lawyer. You have 2 degrees, don't you?
I do.
You do. The world know that. And Andre Oster is with us, who's a client also of the Public Defender's Office, and credits them with saving his life by helping him go through treatment for drug addiction. And Andre, welcome. Good to have you on the air.
Thank you. How are you doing?
Well, how are you?
I'm fine.
Good. Number here is 410-319-8888. So, Nancy, let's talk about this. I mean, this is a very serious issue, and Anthony and I, we're going to cover this hour with you. And the questions you were... I mean, you were fired essentially because you refused to do the bidding, you refused to do what they told you to do.
Correct.
So let's talk about those things.
Mm-hmm.
You were told to disband the Capitol Defense Division.
Right.
And you wrote this lengthy defense of that.
I thought it was. I thought it was fairly clear.
Well, let's just talk about that. I mean,
okay.
What that division does, and one of the things you said in there that you would only disband that division if they ended capital punishment is one of the things you wrote in that.
Right. It's, you know, it seems to me that as long as we have a death penalty in Maryland, it would be quite foolish to just take an inexperienced lawyer from the public defender's office and put them on a capital case because we've dismantled the Capital Defense Division. And one thing I do need to clarify, though, and Mr. McCurdy knows this, the board, after the legislation was passed last session, which made getting the death penalty a lot more difficult, I reconstituted the Capital Defense Division because, in my view, there probably will be less capital cases.
Mm-hmm.
So what I did with, but that's not to say there will never be any. Because it's still, the death penalty still exists. So what I did is I just made the unit the same four lawyers, and remember, we're only talking about four lawyers. I made them what is called the Aggravated Homicide Division and expanded the role that they will play throughout the agency. In other words, if a case arises, let's say, in Baltimore County, which is usually where they all arise in capital area, if a case arises there that would otherwise be eligible for the prosecutor to seek the death penalty under the new statute, these lawyers would enter their appearance in the case, even if no death notice is filed and it just remains your, you know, regular homicide case. So that takes the burden off the local district lawyers. They have one less extremely serious case to handle.
Anthony, do you want to ask questions?
I did. Nancy said that it was four attorneys. I do want to point out there was a social worker assigned to the office as well as support staff, correct?
Right.
And they did more than just want you to disband it. They wanted you to – you were asked to send these staff persons to district offices, correct?
Right.
Which they are at salaries and grades that would made very difficult for them to be integrated into district offices.
Well –
at least I would think.
Right, right.
I think so as well, because of their level of experience and in the capital area, which not a lot of lawyers have, they are paid at a higher level. And in order for me to then just put them out into the district offices to handle a docket of felony cases like the people that they're working side by side with, I can't justify that salary. So I would have to demote them. And that's a disciplinary process, and I had no reason to discipline these attorneys.
Now, one of the interesting things was also to disband the Juvenile Protection Division.
Right, right. The Juvenile Protection Division was a division that I created in 2007 in direct response to an ABA assessment of the juvenile representation in the entire state of Maryland. It wasn't just focused on our agency, but of course, because we represent the majority of juvenile cases, it really did focus on us. And it came up with many, really, I thought that they were embarrassing comments about the representation of juveniles by public defenders. The biggest one, in my opinion, was that sometimes the lawyers didn't get to see their clients until that day in court, which I think is just unethical.
And how did your act change any of that?
Well, what I did, because I know I don't have enough lawyers to do everything, to follow all the recommendations of the assessment, what I did was I formulated this group, the Juvenile Protection Division, again, four lawyers and a social worker, and what they were to do is once a month, every month, they would fan out into all the detention centers, every single detention facility where our juvenile clients may be, and meet with every single one of our clients. And what they do with that information is relay it back to the juvenile line lawyer. And so in that way, I'm paying less in travel expenses, and I'm meeting what I think is an ethical obligation for these juveniles to actually be seen by a lawyer and talk to a lawyer before they actually appear in court. And that's only one of the functions that they do. It's a lot more than just that. And in fact, it's been held up, as far as I know, as a national model, as one of the only kinds of units in existence. But other public defender offices are trying to set that up as well.
Okay, I do want to get to the heart of what I think some of the battle is over, which is what a role of public defenders is. We can introduce other guests in this room and get them into the heart of this conversation. But Anthony, you have a...
Well, just real quick question. I think it will be a great transition to bring folks into what the mission is and the interpretation, obviously, that your board had of their mission.
Mm-hmm.
You knew there would be cuts, correct? I mean, every agency was being made very clear that the governor needed a certain amount of dollars to be cut from across the board, across every agency,
correct.
And your agency wouldn't be spared from that.
No, I knew that.
And now, when the board actually communicated to you what their vision of the public defender's office, which really, well, I mean, I'm not going to make a judgment, but the Capital Defense Division, the Juvenile Protection Division, this Northwest Community Defenders, which has been written about and praised around the country,
mm-hmm.
why not, Nancy, just go along? I mean, I know that sounds so bottom line, but it really is bottom line. Yeah, your board was telling you this is what their vision and of this agency should be, given the financial realities that you all were facing. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of listeners are probably like, why didn't she just go along? She had a job to do, and they gave her her marching orders, and she didn't go along.
Right. I didn't go along because for a couple reasons. Number one, when you want to talk about the budget, this is something nobody seems to mention, including the board. In fiscal year 2009, I reverted back to the state general fund almost $500,000. Mm. That means I did not use $500,000, and I gave it back. That was on top of all of the cuts that were taken from us. But, you know, and so to suggest then that, you know, I'm being frivolous with state money, I think is really unfair. But secondly, and more importantly, I could not live with myself if the Office of the Public Defender and I were the head of it comes down to what this board thinks its function is. I mean, just that's the bottom line. It's against my principles. And quite honestly, I think they're wrong. They're just wrong. And if you read our statute, I think you understand that they're just wrong. And I honestly do not even think that this is about a philosophical difference. I think that there is an agenda by Mr. McCurdy that really has nothing to do with a philosophical difference.
What do you think the agenda is?
I think the agenda, and I know those letters were dated
15 years ago.
15 more years ago, but I'm telling you, I think that's what Mr. McCurdy's agenda is, and always has been and always will be.
And you're going to say that tomorrow?
Yes, I am.
The conversation that Anthony McCarthy and I are having at this moment is with Nancy Forrester, who is the public defender for the state of Maryland, who was fired on August 21st. We did a show about that immediately afterwards. One of the huge pieces of this debate and question is, what's the role of a public defender's office? Is it just to defend people who are indigent and cannot afford attorneys, or is the role larger? In New York State, among other places, they think the role is larger. And they created a neighborhood defender's office in the Bronx and in Harlem that has done astounding work in some wraparound services in New York. New York's way ahead of Baltimore when it comes to the judicial work. I mean, they have their Red Hook courts, which are little community courts that get people to lower the recidivism rates, which this program may or may not do, which is one of the things we're going to examine. But we went to visit the public defender's office in Park Heights 2 weeks ago, I think it was. And I spent a couple hours there meeting with attorneys and with clients and talking and hearing stories. And that's where I got that amazing story about a young man, 41-year-old man I met there who had been arrested for, he kept saying, a straw. And I kept saying kind of what he was talking about when he said he was arrested for a straw.
Yeah.
And I finally said to him, look, I know a lot of, you know, nomenclature and slang from the street. I understand. Well, what is a straw? What does that mean? You know? And he said, a straw. I was driving, got stopped. Yes, I have a record. I did time in prison. I was on probation. There was a straw next to me in my front seat, and they said I was using it to snort drugs, and they busted me. And this guy is a cook in a local restaurant, and he went to jail and did not lose his job because he was away for a while until public defender's office got him out.
Right.
But that's the kind of cases that we're talking about that a lot of black men, especially in this community, face every day. And the public defender's office is a really interesting place. We visit on Park Heights. As I said, we are continuing to be joined by Nancy Forrester on the phone. But in the studio is Natalie Finniger, who runs that office, started in 2007 after visiting the New York programs. Vicki Pointowski, who holds a law degree and a social worker's degree, but she's working as a social worker in the defender's office. Muriel Johnson, who is a Vietnam veteran, an amazing story, and is currently studying addictions counseling here. And Andre Webster is a client also at the public defender's office and credits them with saving his life from drug addiction. And the number here is 410-319-8888. And those who are trying to call in here, I should at least get one caller in. And before we go to our guests, and let's go to Maria, who you've been holding on since the beginning of the show, so please go ahead.
Hi, thank you so much for letting me be on the show, Mark. I think my main concern as a taxpayer is the lack of vision on the part of the trustees, and hopefully not our legislature, to and the social work program with the public defender's office, which actually saves us money. If we can keep people out of the system, if we can save that $79 a day for a bed in jail and put it toward making someone become a taxpayer and kicking in funds, it just doesn't make sense to lose the social workers. Also knowing that attorneys cannot do what a social worker can do. They don't have the skills. They don't have the training.
Absolutely.
Absolutely right.
Do you know the cost for pretrial detention right now is $82 per day in Baltimore City? And it's actually the cost for pretrial detention right now is a number that was just quoted to me by the Department of Public Safety is higher than in the Department of Corrections. And I suspect that's because in Baltimore, there's a lot more health care issues and a lot more addiction care issues than across the entire state. And so $82 a day if somebody's not in jail that we save. And treatment is definitely cheaper. And I think you'll hear from people that treatment is more effective for them than sitting over the detention center.
Before we run out of time, I do want to ask Nancy and Natalie – is this social work component, this preventative component, other public defender's office practice this as well?
Yes.
This is not something unusual.
We are not revolutionary in having social work.
Unfortunately, yeah.
You know, I took the opportunity to kind of take a look state by state. Yeah. And, you know, not everybody has a unified public defender program like we do. So sometimes you have to look at some of the larger cities. And virtually all of the public defender's office have public defenders that they either contract out with or sentencing mitigation specialists that they work with. And if we were to lose our social workers, we'd kind of be joining the likes of Alabama and also Michigan, who's been severely criticized by the NLADA. That's the National Legal Aid and Defenders Association, who takes a look at public defender organizations for not having adequate expense for defense and adequate resources. So to remove social workers from the public defender's office isn't just to take us from the forefront. It's to take us kind of back generations. And it's not the kind of justice that we want.
So, well,
can I jump in?
Yeah, we have only about a minute before we have to go to break. But
what I can't understand and simply can't fathom is why, when the entire trend of the entire criminal justice system is toward rehabilitation, restorative justice, therapeutic justice, when the Office of the Public Defender joins in on that and uses social workers, it's a terrible thing. We have drug treatment courts, we have mental health courts, DUI courts, domestic violence courts, family courts, and that's all about assisting somebody with rehabilitation. And so I don't know why, you know, the Office of the Public Defender should be held to a different standard.
We have to take a very short break. When we come back, the first person we want to talk to is Nick, who's the next caller, who's calling from Washington, D.C., who was an intern with a neighborhood defender's office. We'll hear what he has to say. Then we're going to turn to the social worker we've been talking about and the clients we've been talking about and hear their perspective on what role this office plays. And so join us here at 410-319-8888. We're talking about the battle to save the public defender's office here in the state of Maryland, starting off with the committee hearing tomorrow in judicial proceedings. Urbanite Radio Stories on the Mark Steiner Show are made possible by Maren Alsop and the Baltimore Symphony Orchestra, presenting its 2009-2010 season featuring Kathleen Battle, Andre Watts, Itzhak Perlman, and more. Tickets to the Meyerhoff available at 410-783-8000 or go to bsmusic.org. We'll be right back. Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner, and the Mark Steiner Show is made possible by Johns Hopkins Medicine. For the 19th consecutive year, the Johns Hopkins Hospital is ranked number one by U.S. News & World Report in their annual Best Hospital Survey. Find out more about the nation's top hospital at hopkinsmedicine.org. And as we go back to our program, I want to remind you all to, even though the fund drive is over, we want to thank you all because WEA raised $102,000 during this fund drive. Just phenomenal. Without your help, it wouldn't be possible. But it's not over yet. We want you to go to WEAA.org and continue pledging online to help the station grow. Go to WEAA.org, secure a pledge line, and pledge there, please. But now let's come back to our subjects. And we're in the studio with Nancy Forster, she's on by phone, excuse me, the public defender who was fired August 21st. We're Natalie Finnegar, you just heard before we went to break, along with Nancy Forster, who started the Neighborhood Defenders Program, a Northwest program, Northwest Baltimore, in 2007. Vicki Pointowski is with us, social worker with the Neighborhood Defender's Office. Muriel Johnson and Andre Webster, both clients who have something to say about what happened there. 410-319-8888 is the number here. And Nick in Washington, D.C., you're on the air.
Good afternoon.
Hi, Nick.
Hey, Mark. How are you? Thanks for having me.
Thanks.
Hello, everybody in the studio.
Hi, Nick.
Hello, Nick.
I just want to talk a little bit about my experience with the Neighborhood Defenders. I'm a student at Georgetown now, and I had the privilege to be an intern with the office over the past school year. And, you know, I'm somebody that recognizes the struggle of the poor community and wants to do something to help the people in the community. I think I share that with a lot of the other students here at Georgetown. And one thing that I struggle with is the thought that as a public defender, I can give everything I have to represent a client in court, to take them through the trial process, and, you know, eventually, hopefully get an acquittal for the client. And at that point, what am I going to do? Am I going to say, congratulations, you're free, and you're free to go to wherever you came from, a situation where you don't have a job, where you're not educated, where you struggle with drug addiction. And one thing that really attracted me to the Neighborhood Defenders is that they are focused on wanting to do something to address that dilemma. And I think because the Neighborhood Defenders has that mindset, it's something that really attracts a lot of young law students and a lot of people who could be one day quality attorneys that share that same sentiment, that we really want to do something to help the poor community, but struggle with knowing that we could be doing more to help them than just getting them an acquittal and sending them.
So, Nick, were you in the Montgomery County office or Baltimore City office?
I was in the Baltimore City office working in Park Heights, part-time in Park Heights and part-time downtown in Baltimore.
Nick, thanks so much for joining us. I think it's time now maybe to turn for a few minutes to Vicki Pointowski and to Andre Webster and
Muriel Johnson.
Muriel Johnson. There's so many names in the sheet. I'm just reminded of that. I mean, let's talk about them. You're the problem, Vicki.
I am.
You know, I mean,
the
social workers get in the way here. So just talk about, in all seriousness, what you do there, and then I want to hear from our clients.
Well, I do a couple of different things. What I do is what either the attorney requests or what the client requests. So I absolutely help the attorneys prepare for trial by meeting with the client, by conducting as much of a psychosocial investigation as I can, by talking with the client and any family members and any friends that they give me permission to speak with, by requesting as many records as I can to confirm background information about the client, and by helping the attorney understand the client's issues as a way to either mitigate come sentencing time or as a way to explain why I am creating a treatment plan that we can present to the court as an alternative to sentencing if that's something that would be acceptable in this particular case. But I also work with clients on issues that are unrelated to court if they request that. From my understanding, everybody that is a Neighborhood Defenders client is offered the chance to speak with me, whether their question is related to their upcoming court case or not. And I have plenty of folks that are interested in talking about whether it's substance abuse, treatment, mental health issues, housing, looking for jobs, parenting issues, and they do ask to speak with me before they are released, and they come and speak with me in my office after they're released back into the community as well. I do not provide those direct services. I do not provide drug counseling. I do not provide housing for anyone on demand. I just don't have those things at my disposal. But what I will do is sit and explain to them what services are available for them in the community and how to access them. And if they have difficulty accessing those services, I give them my card and I say, please give me the chance to help follow up and advocate for you.
Vicki, this is Anthony McCarthy, and I have a question for you. When you talk about those wraparound services, and when you talk about not providing direct services, but being there outside of that purview of their interaction with court, do you have in your mind, that's a clear mission for the public defender's office? I think this is where a lot of people find this gray area that employment, housing, parental services, the very fact that you're even offering to move people in that direction or provide that information, I think in some people's mind is beyond the purview of what public defenders should be doing.
What I can say to that is that it's certainly the mission of the Neighborhood Defender's Office, especially based on the Bronx model. I can also tell you that as part of my job in working with clients pre-trial and preparing for court, I have to know about these services anyway. So for me to sit down and talk to somebody for 5 minutes and explain, listen, here's the paperwork, here's my card, this is what you need to do, this is what you need to ask somebody when you get to that desk, and if it doesn't work, call me. I'm happy to make a phone call to intervene for you. It just doesn't take that much extra work for me.
So I'd like to hear from, we have not heard yet from Andre Webster or Muriel Johnson, and talk just very briefly about your stories and you know, the Muriel, let me start with Andre, and we'll go down to Muriel.
Well, it's basically like this with me. I had got incarcerated for a charge that I had, whereas though I was looking at a lot of time, mm-hmm. you know. And basically, when they asked me to, did I want a public defender, I said yes. So, not knowing that I was going to go through seeing a social worker or none of that, I just was looking at, you know, getting an attorney.
Right.
You know, for someone like me anyway that didn't have any money, you know. So, then she asked me, did I want treatment, my public defender. And I said, yes.
Treatment for what?
Treatment for my drug addiction.
Okay.
Yeah, I was active in drug addiction for 14 years.
Okay.
You know, and
Now, Andre, did you see any direct connection to the public defender asking you about treatment and the public defender preparing for your case to defend you in court?
Yes, I did.
You did, okay.
Yes, I did. But when she asked me, did I want treatment, I wasn't looking at it as just treatment. I was looking at it for real, on the honesty, as a get-out-of-jail-free card,
mm-hmm.
you know. And when she said that she was going to send her social worker to see me and evaluate me, this was a first for me, you know. I have never been through, I mean, I have always used a public defender, but I have never knew nothing about a social worker. And I said, like a week later, Miss Vicki Patowski came and seen me. And she, when we sat down in the office.
Were you inside then in jail?
Yeah, I was at Central Booking.
Mm-hmm.
And when she sat me down in the office and we talked, I just opened up like a butterfly and just talked to her. I mean, it's because the demeanor that she had just let me just flow right along with her,
mm-hmm.
you know. And she evaluated me, and the public defender came back and seen me and told me that we're going to try to get this in court as soon as possible. But as the process of that trying to get me in court, I had a bail release. And I thought it was over with. The thing that surprised me the most, that Ms. Vicki still called me while I was at home. And still dealt with my case, still took care of the treatment process for me, you know, gave me the legwork and told me what all I had to do. And then she sent me to, it was like a treatment day where you just go in and everybody just get assessed for treatment and they accept you. And I got accepted to a treatment program. I got accepted to a treatment program that has been good to me and has done everything that I always wanted to do. I just could not do it on my own, you know. So
how long ago was this?
This was May 12th, 2008.
So for over a year and a third, you've been clean and in this program?
Yes, sir.
And what are you doing now?
I'm currently, well, I'm saying volunteering at the treatment program that I had.
Okay.
You know, and
so, and how was the case adjudicated?
No, it was no jail time, probation upon my treatment, completing.
So let me just jump over to Muriel for a minute. And Muriel Johnson, a Vietnam veteran.
That's
right. And so I know, when we talked, when we first met, man, I knew you had a really long story. We're going to have that tell you that just a little bit. Too,
yeah.
So why don't you?
Well, I just happened to be, the public defender's office was at the right place when I was in the wrong time.
Let me set you up.
Right.
All right. Because your story is amazing. Mm. Let me set you up. You're a Vietnam veteran.
Yes.
Saw combat in Vietnam.
Yes.
Came home with post-traumatic stress disorder, but you also had a less than honorable discharge, so you couldn't get treatment.
Right.
you spent 30-some years in a job.
Right.
As a security officer.
Right.
In the federal government.
Federal government. Yeah.
All that while having an addiction when you got depressed.
Suffering, yeah. And self-medicating.
Self-medicating with cocaine.
Cocaine, right? Yes, sir.
And then you had an episode.
Right. My son was murdered. And right after that, I suffered a psychotic episode. And I wound up at Park Heights in Belvedere with a .40 caliber in my hand, firing it. And so in 58 years, I found myself on the other side of the law.
You've never been arrested before, ever?
No, mistaken. You know, like what it was, 1968, you know, but the charges would drop. Mm-hmm. You know, mistaken identity.
68's a long time ago.
Yeah, yeah, you know. So, and that's where, you know, my journeys begin. And in my case, I was in a position where I couldn't help myself. I didn't know who I was, or I couldn't even defend myself. So that's where I was introduced to my lawyer from the public defender's office. And from there, that's when you put your life, you know, you have to have something that, at that point, I needed something to hold on to. And she extended her hand. So.
And you went into treatment? You spent how much? You spent 10 months in jail?
10 months in
before
jail.
Before you get out?
10 months at Spring Grove Hospital. I spent 6 months in treatment. I'm currently at a transitional house, which I volunteered to go to. I could have went home, but 40 years in it, it's not going to happen overnight, but I'm making progress a day at a time.
That's all you can do.
And you're actually studying now to be an addictions counselor.
Yes. I'm now, at BCC.
Go ahead, I'm sorry.
With a major in addiction counseling.
Wonderful.
And let me add a little piece to the story here, then I'm going to open the phone so that our listeners come into this conversation again, is that you told the story of how you had a flashback and a psychotic episode after your son was murdered. You had a gun. You shot your next-door neighbor.
Yes.
Who you love like a son.
Yes.
I'm just paraphrasing the story that you told me.
Right.
That you shot the who you love like a son. He forgave you because he knew you didn't. He knew you were not in your right mind when you did it.
Right.
He still forgives you. And then you were seeing ghosts, as you said, on the corner.
Right.
Around you. And I think people understand if you have not been to war, you don't get it.
Right. Yeah.
What can happen and what you see.
Right.
To some men who go, now women who go through this. So I just want to lay that out, let people know, you know, where you've come to. So let's go back to, let's go to the phones. We're talking about the future of the public defender's office. Tomorrow there's a hearing in judicial proceedings over the firing of Nancy Forster, the makeup of the board, and what is the role of the public defender's office? Is it just to put a lawyer out there, or is these wraparound services that reach into people's lives and help change things? And maybe the question I want to ask is, in a minute, is, because they're going to ask this, you know, in the legislature, is it saving us money? Because the bottom line is money. 410-319-8888 is the number here. Mark in Harford County, you're on the air.
Thank you, Mark, for having me. Thank you, both panel members. It sounds like, and this is even after listening to testimonies of your guests, it sounds like it's an attack on people's rights to have an attorney, to have a robust defense, and it sounds like it's an attack on your constitutional rights. To me, it sounds like, I guess, an initial attack. And where do these cuts stop? If you can cut the public defender's office, can you start cutting social workers from the Department of Social Services and Department of Human Resources? Where does the cut start? Is that the initial cut of social programs? And can you all answer that?
To turn to Natalie and Vicky for a moment.
Well, you know, I think social workers are absolutely essential to a good defense these days. And the reason why is our whole criminal justice system has changed. I think Nancy Forster referred to all these specialty courts that have happened and all of these sentencing alternatives that we're looking for. We've started to realize that incarcerating people and throwing away the key is missing the point. And so people are looking for what do you do with individuals that come into the criminal justice system and how do you address their needs, whether it's mental health treatment or addiction treatment. I'm not trained to do that. I'm trained to be a lawyer. I'm trained to present a case in court, and I care a great deal about my clients, and I think most public defenders, if not all of them, absolutely do the same. But I need the person next to me who tells me exactly what the addiction problem is, what kind of treatment it needs, and then what kind of mental health issues are there. And quite frankly, it's cheaper to have our office do that because Vicki, I think, would like to point out, you know, she opted to work as a social worker instead of an attorney, and she makes a lot less money. Social workers across the board get paid less money than attorneys. And so the fact that she can present a workup for me that I can then take to court that saved me 10 or 15 hours of my time means that I'm free to do more cases. And it makes a great deal of sense. It's what judges want. It's what prosecutors want. And we lack the ability to do it without a social worker next to us to help us get through the records and find out what treatment's appropriate.
And I especially, Mark, I'm very interested in, and you and I talked about this today. We talked about it right after Nancy Forster was fired. What it means for children and juveniles. It appears to me that we have, even when they look at the bottom line, this preventative idea of providing young people with that, not just a second chance, but with opportunities that really are that give them options, that give them choices, that give them opportunities to get help for their mental health problems, get help for their family problems, get help. And I just wonder, I guess I'm curious, and I shouldn't even throw this out here. We've avoided it this whole hour, of where the administration stands on this. Because I know that this governor has talked about juvenile services. He's talked about the incarceration of juveniles. And this, I just, when I look at this and I read Mr. McCurdy's letter and I read Nancy Forster's letter, it raises a huge specter about where our priorities lie when it comes to children in this state. I mean, it's just in my head.
I think that's a show we ought to do in the next couple of weeks.
Yeah, I do too.
We should do that. Let me go back to the phones at 410, because I think you're right. 410-319-8888. Lisa, you're on the air. Hi, Lisa, you there?
I'm a current social work student, and I just wanted to commend this model that the Neighborhood Defender's Office currently works by. As social workers in school right now, we're really trained to take care of two clients, the person that's in front of you and also the environment in which they interact. That's almost an entire client in and of itself. And attorneys, when they're working with their clients, they're rightfully so just focused on that person in front of them. But as social workers, they can provide that link and specialized knowledge about how the environment influenced this person. And for those clients in Northwest Baltimore, I imagine that growing up in that area truly plays a role in these cycles of drug dependency that they've experienced. And so with the collaboration of social work and the law, we can help these clients and recognize how their past has affected their predicament and then how the future can be changed. And I just only hope when I graduate, there are still positions like this available so that I can, as a social worker, holistically treat these clients and meet them where they are at.
Lisa, thank you so much for getting through today and talking to us. I'm very curious, very quickly, Andre Webster and Muriel Johnson, just are you guys like aberrations? You know what I'm saying? Are you like
unusual
in this in terms of what goes on that you've seen in the public defender's office?
It's unusual to me because, like I said, I never experienced this. You know what I'm saying? I never even knew social work even occurred in public defender's office. You know, so, I mean, I'm listening to the callers and everybody y'all had online, the senator and Ms. Foster, you know. I mean, man, I really think, man, that them people should just give it a chance. You know, I mean, because they don't understand, man. I mean, in the neighborhood that they're in, I have grown up there. I've been there since birth.
Park Heights.
You know, and we are one of the worst neighborhoods in Baltimore City.
But Nancy, or Natalie, is what Mark's asking is a very important question. We have these two wonderful gentlemen in front of us who obviously were impacted by every component of the public defender's office of the defenders. But are they aberrations? I mean, are they so unusual? Is this worth
Well, what I can tell you, we're in the process of putting together some outcome measures, and I think that's very important. I think it's important to show bed day saved.
Yes.
As much as to me, it's really about the two people that are sitting on either side of me. I understand the language of the legislature and our funders, but we were able to add up. We've put 100 clients into long-term inpatient treatment. And yes, not everybody who gets into treatment the first time is successful. Addiction is very difficult to battle. But if you look at, you know, $82 a day, and just round it down to 80 because I went to law school because I'm not good at math, right? And say you save, you know, 30 days of in jail pretrial time for those folks, you start adding up to hundreds of thousands of dollars. I think it came up to about $240,000. So 100 people in inpatient treatment. And we could have never have done it without Vicki. And we hear from our clients that it makes a huge difference. Expungements that happen in our office, we hear back from our clients, it made a difference for them to get a job.
Expungements are a big, huge part of what
big
you do.
Deal.
It's
deal.
Every Wednesday we have drop-in hours. And if you're out there and if you're a public defender client, come to 4151 Park Heights Avenue from 9 to 5. If you're eligible for an expungement, we want to help you get whatever you can off of your record, get it cleaned up, give you some advice about how you respond to employers, about any record that remains for you so that you can go out and get a job.
And very quickly, Muriel, before we have to end the program, if you were testifying tomorrow, mm-hmm. what would you say to them?
Well, I would say to put the focus back on the mission. You know, the mission is to help the people. You know, and you hurt them when you making cuts like this, because just like in my case. Up until I got arrested, I could have afford a lawyer. I could have did this. I could have did that.
You had a job.
Yeah, but the circumstances, my life changed in a second. Mm-hmm. I didn't have no job, no future, you know, no family. You know, I was in limbo. But it was just, you know, because of this program, I got my life back. You know, and it's not like you say we're special, because every man needs encouragement. And that's like I was telling Ms. Bonkowski, she did things in my situation that eased my pain and hurt, you know, with my family, things that she went the extra mile. And, you know, and just like she said, you know, that human element.
And it's I'm thinking about Nancy Forster said at the beginning of the program, we're in an era where we're talking about restorative justice, about trying to help people change their lives, and that's what you all are about in this office on right. Park Heights.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and they do a good job.
It changed my life.
Yeah, it changed mine too. And thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Folks, do we have time for another caller? Quick cut. Dee, you have like 30 seconds to make a comment.
Yes, hi. My name is Dee Zipperly. I'm a social worker with the Public Defender's Office, Juvenile Protection Division. And I just wanted to say that I very much admire the zealous advocacy that Ms. Forster has provided, and I'm baffled by the decisions to cut some of the services. I believe these services are greatly needed. These are people, living and breathing people. They're not case files. And people need services. They're our brothers, they're our sisters, they're our grandparents, they're our children. And when you talk about people that come from places that are akin to the Baghdad of Baltimore City, it just doesn't, it's unfathomable to me that we can talk about cutting services to these folks.
Dee, thank you so much for your closing thoughts. I want to thank Natalie Finniger and Vicki Portowski for coming in here today. Especially
thank you,
want to
Bob.
Thank
you.
Andre West and Muriel Johnson for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good luck.
Thank you.
With what you got. And thank you for serving our country, Muriel.
Thank you, sir.
And we also want to thank Nancy Forrester for joining us early, as well as Senator Brian Frosch, holding the committee hearings tomorrow, judicial proceedings at 1:30 tomorrow.
1 o'clock.
1 o'clock tomorrow, thank you. Mm-hmm. In Annapolis, and we will follow up on that with them after the hearings are over and keep following the story to see where it takes us. Thank you all so much for everything
you
do.
Thank you.
The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by Urbanite, Baltimore's monthly magazine of ideas and innovation. This month, Urbanite explains a new movement in architecture and design. to beat the downsizing of Baltimore City and offers an in-depth look behind the state's biggest transportation project. It's The Building Issue, available at over 800 locations. Visit www.urbanitebaltimore.com for a list of drop locations. We'll be right back with a different story. Anthony and I will stay with us.